You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Hooman.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
You know, I don't have any major complaints to share with you right now. Maybe we'll talk after the recording.
Okay.
And I'll come up with some things, but for present purposes.
Same here.
Yeah.
On a personal level, same here. On a broader societal level,
yeah.
Many complaints.
Well, unfortunately, we are going to get into broader issues.
Yes.
Having to do with global affairs.
Yeah.
The mood may darken. But let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Hooman Majd,
yep.
A longtime observer of Iranian affairs. And you come by that, you might say naturally. I mean, your father was a diplomat in Iran before the revolution of 1979. Your grandfather was an Ayatollah, as I recall.
Correct, yep.
You have written a number of books about Iran, most recently, Minister Without a Portfolio, Memoir of a Reluctant Exile.
Correct.
Before that, I know the Ayatollah Begs to Differ was one of your books some time ago.
Yeah, that was one. Ayatollah's Democracy was another. The Ministry mm-hmm. of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay was another one, which was more memoirish, although not mm-hmm. really a memoir, but really the title referred to the fact that ever since then, it's been kind of awkward for me to be able to go to Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Been interrogated, been, you know, passport taken away, all that kind of stuff that many other diaspora Iranians who have a somewhat of a public profile in the West suffer from.
You are viewed with suspicion.
With suspicion, and also in my particular case, because I have a familial relationship to the former president, reformist mm-hmm. president Khatami, Mohammad Khatami, who is mm-hmm. despised by the mm. hardliners, and a good relationship with the former foreign minister, Zarif. If they can't get them and put them in jail, they'll get the next best thing.
And I should add, you served as translator
Correct.
For an earlier Iranian president while he was touring the U.S., and it has recently been reported that Mossad had tried, possibly with success, to cultivate him as an asset. And indeed, I don't want to talk about this now, but I want to get to this and see what you have to say about it. And indeed, he had been anointed, apparently, according to some reports, as the leader of the government that was supposed to take place in this supposedly clean regime change operation that Trump and Netanyahu launched at the end of February.
Apparently, he was one of the choices to be the Delcy of Iran.
I definitely want to talk about that.
Yeah.
I actually have some inside anecdote that I'd be curious as to your reaction to. But right now, the news is that Trump has declared, I guess you could say, a second war on Iran. The first one didn't work out that well. This one sounds like it's going to be purely economic.
Mm-hmm.
He posted, I think yesterday, that he's basically demanding that all nations cut off all economic ties with Iran, and there will be crushing consequences for any nations that don't. Now, this just sounds so ridiculously amorphous that it can't possibly kind of fully transpire. On the other hand, the United Arab Emirates, perhaps not coincidentally, said at roughly the same time, I think, they were cutting off all ties with Iran. Now, whether they do that is another question. But so...
And they haven't yet.
And they haven't yet. Okay.
And the main thing with that is, I mean, it's an interesting... Yes, it's economic warfare. When you combine the blockade mm-hmm. with this supposed crushing sanctions regime on Iran, it is absolute economic warfare, trying to collapse the regime by economic means rather than by military means, because military means, we now know, won't work.
Mm-hmm.
And the economic means, it's interesting because will there be pain? It would be mostly felt by the Iranian people, not by the leadership. Is it going to be effective? Well, let's see. I mean, the Emirates, Abu Dhabi has a different view of Iran than Dubai does. Dubai has a lot of Iranian businesses, a lot of Iranians. Mm-hmm.
And those are both Emirates, right?
Both Emirates. They're both part of the United Arab Emirates. Yeah, Dubai has very, very close trading ties, whether it's just the Dows going across the Persian Gulf, taking, you know, refrigerators and Samsung goods and, you know, MacBooks and iPhones across from Dubai. And there's many, many entrenched Iranian businesses that don't even have an Iranian name. And to remember that there were Iranian immigrants in Dubai, for example, mostly Dubai, prior to it becoming an independent state, prior to the Emirates, when it was still a British protectorate. Mm-hmm. And at that time, when it became a state, people had a choice to become citizens, the ones who were living, had been living there for, in some cases, 50, 60 years as traders. And a lot of them took Emirati citizenship, but are actually originally Iranian. And so there's quite a big population of that. We have no idea if the IRGC have their tentacles into that community. But so far throughout these 35, 40 years of probably going all the way back to 47, but let's say at least 35, 40 years of heavy sanctions on the Iranian regime, Dubai has been a source of income for Iran, cash, gold, trade. Yeah. And whether that's going to stop altogether tomorrow, I don't see that.
About these reports as of like a few days ago, last week or something, that actually UAE had started shipping large quantities of money to Iran. Yes. And in exchange, Iran was doing something, withholding military attacks, yes, possibly facilitating the transfer of oil. UAE stuff through the...
Yeah,
right.
Ship transfers.
Was that actually happening? I think...
That was a rumor. That was a rumor. And the Iranian Central Bank, I think, denied. But it was very suspicious because Flight Radar had two Emirati government jets leave the Emirates, and I can't remember which one, Dubai or Abu Dhabi airport, and land at an airport just outside of Tehran, Karaj, which is a kind of a suburb of Tehran, and sit at that airport for like less than an hour and then return. If it was for meetings, people have assumed that they would stay longer than an hour on the tarmac. Mm-hmm. So there was this rumor there was like $3.5 billion worth of Iranian money / gold that was brought. Now, whether that's true or not is almost irrelevant. The reality is that the Emirates have to play both sides here. They have to be cognizant of the fact that they are in the Abraham Accords. They like their relationship with the United States and with Israel because they have an intelligence and arms deal with the Israelis. But they also are neighbors of Iran and are very vulnerable to Iranian attacks. They're going to play, they're going to be very careful. And I think the statement by the UAE foreign ministry saying they're cutting off financial ties is what they said initially. They're suspending financial ties. I think that probably was more to appease President Trump and the Trump and Scott
Messent. That was what I assumed.
Than the reality that they're really going to start cracking down on all those exchanges and the Dow captains taking ships across the Persian Gulf. I mean, it doesn't seem like that's a very practical thing. Will it be back to the same level of cooperation that Iran, a financial cooperation with the UAE that they had prior to the June war last year? Probably not. But we also have China, which is probably their second biggest, I think, partner. Iran's second biggest. I'm not 100% sure. UAE and China. I mean, we're not talking about Europe, obviously. They already have no financial ties with Iran. So that's irrelevant. We're not really talking about Africa so much or South America now that Venezuela's gone. So we're really only talking about Asia. We're talking about China as the biggest trading partner. And I don't see how... President Xi is just going to say, "Yeah, fine, we'll just stop doing."
No way. I mean, he's not going to publicly signal any degree of submission to Trump's demand. And secondly, I just don't think he's all that worried about the consequences. No. I mean, what is Trump going to do? Trump says there will be tremendous economic consequences. What is Trump going to do to China? He's got enough trouble trying to get out of the trouble he's gotten himself into with gratuitous, you know, economic warfare with China.
China can retaliate in a way that practically no other country can. I mean, yeah. China can retaliate against us economically in a way that the UAE can't. You know, there's some countries that can retaliate, other countries that absolutely are not on the position.
Why don't we try to read Trump's mind a little bit and ask kind of what led to this? I mean, obviously, generically, it seems like what led to this is what Trump had done wasn't working in getting him what he wants. And I guess the most immediate thing he wants is the true opening of the Hormuz Strait and Iran to say, okay, we surrender on this issue. We have nothing to say about the traffic that flows. All traffic can flow and so on. That, of course, is not going to happen.
No.
And everyone who analyzes the Iranian government knows that, and they agree on it and long have pretty much.
Yeah.
And so I guess Trump thinks he thinks that if you put enough pressure on them, they will submit. And it's certainly possible you could put enough pressure on them so they'd start to worry. But it seems to me that all the signs are that if you did that, they would escalate. That is the character of this regime. I mean, they are determined to make this the big, you know, the mother of all confrontations, so to speak.
Yeah.
And reset the table once and for all and establish that America can't push them around. And so I worry that if Trump really persists with this, and who knows, if he succeeds in putting much additional pressure on, there's already, God knows, economic pressure on Iran.
Huge.
I mean, they're not getting nearly all their oil out, and there's the sanctions and so on. But if he does back them into more of a corner, I can imagine this thing exploding in a way it hasn't yet. Although we should add, there's plenty of little brush fires in the region right now,
yeah.
And it's kind of incendiary enough as it is.
Yeah.
But what do you think Trump is? What's he thinking, hoping, and what might you disagree with about what I just said?
I think it's pretty clear that his inclination to increase military pressure on Iran, going back to kinetic action. Advisors around him have obviously told him that that's one, not going to work. It's going right. to, we don't even have the equipment, enough equipment, as we know from all the reports of how depleted the stocks are. And also the allies in the region have probably said, hey, look, you know, you start bombing Iran again, they're going to bomb us.
Right.
We've already lost the Bahrain base. There's a lot that Iran has actually done to the United States that is incredibly damaging, which is why some people say Iran's already won the war. And in a way, they have. They've won the military side of the war. They haven't yet won the economic side. But yes, I agree with you that I think that Trump is thinking, well, what else can I do to not look like I've lost? How do I, the old saying was that President Johnson kept going in the Vietnam War because he was going to be the first American to lose a war, first American president. And is Trump is going to be one? I'll be damned if I'm going to be the first American president to lose a war, or a second American president to lose a war.
Or third, or fourth, however you want to calculate it.
But he needs to have in his own mind, a success, even if it's only for his own base. He needs to have success. He needs to be able to. I mean, I think he knows that he cannot convince people that this war has been a success so far. So he has to take it to the conclusion where he can claim success. Now, what he's missing in this picture is that, yes, Iran would negotiate with him, but they're going to negotiate on equal terms. They're not going to surrender. So the way the Iranians saw the MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding, and the reason that fell apart is because they felt the United States was engaging in subterfuge by using the Oman side to escort ships through the Persian Gulf.
Which began, like 4 or 5 days after the MOU was signed?
Correct.
That initiative began. And I have tried to emphasize this because it doesn't get much emphasized in the mainstream media.
No.
That us taking that action was really what led the thing to unravel.
100%. That was
100%. It's so hard. I mean, you try to find that in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington
Post.
There was one reference in the Wall Street Journal that just about got there, but it's kind of unbelievable. And they repeatedly depict it as like, well, Iran decided to start firing at tankers.
Right.
Well, No, I mean, the U.S. started encouraging tankers to evade the Iranian checkpoint that everybody knew was going to be there, and they weren't even charging tolls at that point, I think.
No, because the memorandum, they were following, according to their own calculations, they were following the memorandum. They said Article number 5 says ships have to coordinate with this Persian Gulf, you know, authority that they created. And they agreed not to charge for 60 days, to not charge a toll for that 60-day period. So they weren't charging tolls. But they were seeing ships go and avoid their side and not communicate with them, go dark, you know, the GBS go dark and their transponders go dark, and be escorted by the U.S. Navy. So they said, wait, you can't do this. And then they said, well, if you're going to do this, we're going to fire on your ships. And so then the Trump administration said, well, they broke the deal because they broke the ceasefire, because now they're firing. So when they break the ceasefire, we're going to bring the blockade back and we're going to start bombing Iran. So, yeah, I mean, some people called it a memorandum of misunderstanding, but it was pretty clear. That Article 5 was pretty clear.
That's the other thing I say when people say, well, different sides read different things into it. No, I think the people who signed it and negotiated it knew what that part meant. And I don't know if Trump ever did, but the story I would love to see, if mainstream American journalists ever got to the point where they understood that what we just said happened actually happened, the next thing I'd like to see is somebody do some reporting and find out what changed our position. Who talked Trump into suddenly playing tough 5 days into the MOU?
Yeah.
That would be a very illuminating piece of information.
Yeah.
But apparently no one is interested.
Well, I mean, I think there's, you know, there are these organizations like, you know, think tanks like FDD and United Against
Foundation for Defense of Democracy. Yeah, I mean, they're always doing that, but
yeah. And they have allies. They have allies in the media, in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, and you know, various outlets. They you know, all their people who work for those organizations are constantly doing op-eds everywhere. Mostly in the right-wing press, rarely in the New York Times, but occasionally even in the New York Times. So, I mean, that gets to Trump. That does get to his circle. You got Laura Loomer. You've got, you know, Mark Levin. Mark Levin. There's a lot of, and then you've got the Israelis on top of that, and that's a quieter kind of like push into the White House. I have no idea what Netanyahu is saying to him, but sure, Netanyahu, I mean, may not want full blown warfare, but he certainly likes what's going on right now, you know.
Yeah. So Trump does this thing, stumbles back into this thing that the MOU had gotten him out of.
Yeah.
And so once again, the price of oil is pretty high. Gas is more than $4 a gallon.
Yep.
You still got these midterms approaching. So he's got kind of a mess. And I guess the latest thinking is, well, maybe if we apply enough economic pressure, they will relent or something. So I guess we agree that seems to be roughly his
calculation.
Thinking.
Yeah.
Now, how do you see this playing out? I mean, let's assume that he succeeds in somewhat ratcheting up the economic pressure on Iran, which isn't totally clear to me. With Trump, who knows? He may withdraw this in 12 hours.
Yeah.
And there may be such limited compliance that it won't matter. But if the regime starts to hurt more and more economically, which will happen eventually anyway, given the sanctions and the fact that the shipments in and out of the strait are greatly constricted.
Yes.
How do you imagine, what's the first thing that happens when you get beyond that boiling point from the regime's point of view?
Well, I mean, I think the regime, I mean, what you sort of indicated earlier is that the regime may feel like its only choice. First of all, for the regime, this is existential. This is not existential for the United States. The United States can pack up its military and leave the Persian Gulf tomorrow, and no one would care. Well, I shouldn't say no one would care. No American would really be affected by it, nor would Trump's presidency be drastically affected by it. And the American government wouldn't be especially affected by it. Iran looks at this very differently. This is existential for them. And so I think that there are two options. One is that they indicate, which they already have indicated, to Trump and the administration through the mediators, through both Qatar, Oman, and the Pakistanis. Now, look, if you go back to the MOU, we can sit down and negotiate again. So just go back to the MOU. They've actually said that. If the United States abides by the MOU, which means lifting the blockade, not escorting ships on the Oman side, and delivering some of the cash that they said they were going to, unfreeze the $6 or $7 billion that's sitting in Qatar, in Qatar banks, which was supposed to be released, and now the Iranians want it front-loaded. So agree to do that, and we will sit down and negotiate. We'll go back. We'll go back to the MOU. So that's one potential way to resolve it from their perspective, from the Iranians, to say, yeah, we're happy to negotiate with you if the pain is that much. The other one is like what you said, which is escalate, you know, and they can cause pain. They know that they can cause pain for the United States. They know their missiles can hit. They have now very accurate missiles. They can hit us again and again. They can hit our ships. You know, I guess the USS Lincoln has just left the Persian Gulf, the George Washington on its way there. I don't think they're going to start attacking, you know, aircraft carriers, but they could certainly attack some of the smaller boats. They could destroyers or whatever. I mean, all you need is a couple of sailors to die. And what does Trump do? You know, I don't know. I think that, I mean, that's their the Iranian calculation is we have no choice, because if Trump's idea is that this either collapses the regime, and if it collapses the regime, there could be anarchy. We don't know who takes over. There is no organized opposition, at least on the ground in Iran. The organized opposition here outside of Iran are two groups, the MEK, who have really no chance of succeeding in Iran, and Pahlavi, the former Crown Prince Pahlavi, who has an organization on some level and has some support in Iran. There's no question he has some support in Iran. But in order for Pahlavi to go in an anarchy situation in Tehran with thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands of armed regime militants, military people still in existence, he would have to be escorted by American troops. He would not be able to go in. He doesn't have an army. It's just, I mean, the only thing I can say is I think that, you know, the Iranians will react if this continues, if this economic war continues and continues to hurt them in a way that Trump believes it's good, or Bessent said they're going to collapse the economy, then they will have to lash out. They will have no choice but to lash out. Unless the mediators, and through the mediators, they can get that message, or, you know, the foreign minister, Araghchi, who does have a direct line to Witkoff, says, look, we'll talk, just get your president to agree to go back to the MOU, or at least on some level, or whatever. Mm. Those are the two choices. There is no other choice at this point.
Do Witkoff and Araghchi have the power to just pick up the phone and call each other, literally?
They do. They do have
That's reassuring.
Yeah. Well, it's reassuring, except Witkoff apparently completely misunderstood what Araghchi was saying back in June when he was negotiating with him. He thought that Araghchi was boasting that they had the capacity to build 12 nuclear bombs. And he comes back and tells Trump, oh, they were boasting that they can build 12 nuclear bombs. So let's go.
Oh, bomb. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, that was reported. It's not my.
Yeah. Person. Yeah. Well, I mean, the existence of the telephone line is reassuring. What is on the Washington end of the line is not, which is Witkoff.
Yes. But, yes.
It's interesting because, you know, if Iran does lash out militarily, and lash out is in a way a misleading term because they're pretty calculating in their escalations. Yes. It wouldn't be wild from their point of view, but if it was perceived as something that Trump had to respond to very forcefully, I think we know that it's not going to be Iran that is the first one to back down. So you can imagine an escalation. And I assume Trump is mindful of the fact that he's under a lot of pressure from the Pentagon to quit expending all these missiles, especially anti-missile missiles. As you mentioned, there's been a lot of publicity about how depleted the stocks are. And, you know, although I don't think Iran wants to return to full-fledged war involving Israel, but the fact is, if you imagine that happening, and then firing missiles toward Israel at the rate they had been, and us using anti-missile, you know, missile defense stuff at the rate we had been, it wouldn't take many weeks before people at the Pentagon are just yelling and screaming that, you know, our military is soon not going to be able to defend Florida if Trump doesn't stop. So that's what, if he were a rational actor, that's what you would have to worry about, is a military response that leads to an escalation that leads him to blow another like 500 Patriots and 100 Thads or something, or whatever they have. Because at that point, it's not that you don't have any left. It's just that you can't pretend you're still a military presence in Asia. You can't pretend, you know, all the things they want to pretend, they can't pretend. Right. And, you know,
yeah, and
that's against the rules.
No, absolutely. I mean, I don't think Iran has any real intention to take the war back to Israel.
I don't think they want to.
No, but I mean, I think they would, if Israel joined with Trump in bombing Iran again, or assassinating, mm-hmm. like, you know, the supreme leader, or assassinating the president, or, you know, going through the same, you know, playbook that they've been going on with. Yes, Iran could be. And by the way, Israel suffered from some of those missiles. And I don't think Israel wants to do that either. I don't think Netanyahu really wants missiles flying when he's up for election right now. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the number of emigrants out of Israel is reaching some sort of record now. People are emigrating out of Israel because it's they don't see it as safe anymore with what's going on with the wars in the Middle East, with the war in the Middle East. But anyway, Trump's thinking, you know, we can't play amateur psychiatrists or psychologists or therapists with Trump, but I mean, he's all over the place. I think, you know, he doesn't have anybody. There isn't a single person in his, I mean, I guess with perhaps the exception of the CIA director, everyone else is just a yes man. And Rubio to a lesser extent, but even Rubio seems, you know, less interested in Iran. Doesn't want to get his hands dirty with Iran, focusing on other things, especially Cuba, for obvious reasons, and to some degree Venezuela. And let's, you know, these are people who are, you know, thinking about running in a couple of years. So they're less yes men.
No, but, I think Rubio's last act in that regard was to cut Israel's such a good deal from Israel's point of view on Lebanon.
Yes.
As to threaten to undermine the MOU and undermine J.D. Vance, who is associated with negotiations with Iran, who is, of course, his rival for president. But just interject that and leave it.
No, it's important. Ahead. No, that's important. That's an important factor. But I mean, what the point I was trying to make is, you know, when Obama was president, and this is not to praise Obama, overly praise Obama, but on Iran, he had all these different Iran experts telling him things, including anti-Islamic Republic people who were telling him things, which it wasn't an easy negotiation. Was John Kerry, like, you know, really pro making a deal? Yes, he was. I was there for almost every single one of those rounds of negotiations. John Kerry, for a Secretary of State, had become focused solely on this on the JCPOA, and he got criticized for it. But Obama himself, sitting in the White House, listened to a lot of different people on Iran, and Trump only listens to one group of people on Iran, and the other ones who were a little bit more, you know, cautious, like J.D. Vance. Don't really, because they're going to run for president and they really still want that base, Trump's base, to vote for them. They're not going to be too vocal. They're going to be vocal, but not too vocal and not public. Mm-hmm. And you look at someone like, you know, Tucker Carlson, who said this is insane. It's out of the question. I mean, he broke his relationship. Trump broke off his relationship with Tucker over it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and I think people recognize that. Marjorie Taylor Greene, same thing. Broker his relationship over.
I still think we may see a Tucker MTG ticket, a third party ticket. I wouldn't totally rule it out.
I wouldn't rule it out at all. I agree. And he, if they could take away some of the MAGA vote, yes.
I think the Democrats would win if you saw that.
Yes.
And they might think, well, we taught them a lesson. You can't, you know, if you're gonna let the neocons run the foreign policy, the Republican Party's not gonna be viable. That's That's the message we're sending from Tucker's point of view. I mean, so let's talk a little about what you take to be the current kind of mindset of the regime. I mean, you're much more plugged into these all the relevant news sources. I have, you know, you read about them having, I mean, as of a few days ago before the latest round of stuff, as kind of feeling their oats, but I have no idea. I mean, do you think they feel, you know, pretty damn secure at the moment, barring, months of continued economic pressure or how do you think they're looking at the Hormuz thing? And I'm curious as to what you think is going on in Hormuz. I mean, the U.S. has floated this story that actually they've got a covert action that has succeeded in opening up that Omani corridor. I'm a little skeptical as to how effective it's been. I mean, let me put off the question of the strait. First, why don't you make any observations you have about the regime, just as of, not necessarily in response to Trump's latest threats, but just how they're feeling.
I think you're right to say that they are feeling pretty secure and feeling like they defeated the U.S. militarily. That they feel, they absolutely believe they defeated the U.S. militarily in a physical war. They are rebuilding their missile stocks comfortably. They are still in possession of their uranium, enriched uranium stocks. And the regime is still standing and very present on the streets of Iran, which is intimidating to any potential uprising or any potential new demonstrations, the kind we saw in January before the war, which started out as economic demonstrations, not regime change demonstrations. So they are well aware that economically the people are very unhappy. But what has happened in this war is there's been some level of rallying around the flag, some nationalism, some sense of, you know, we're under attack, and so we kind of, this is not the time to talk about regime change. There has been that sense. Now, I'm not saying that will last forever, because if there isn't any more military attacks, it's possible that people will get, so frustrated with the economic situation, not being able to afford to go out, not being able to afford to buy meat, less than they could, rationing of gasoline potentially, electricity blackouts in a country that is supposedly should have enough electricity. All those things could lead to real dissatisfaction. But the way the regime sits now, let's remember that with that MOU, they exported 80 million barrels of oil. Mm-hmm. So they probably have a cushion, and they probably think they can last through the midterm. So it's not that long, 3 months. We're talking about 3 months. And they certainly feel that they can last 3 months. But I think there's a sense, and some of the people you have to remember who are in the leadership were revolutionaries at the time of the revolution and at the time of the hostage crisis and at the time of deciding they were going to punish Jimmy Carter for letting the Shah into Iran, into the U.S.
And that is what the seizure of the hostages was about, right? They were demanding the return of the Shah. Demanding. I mean, people forget that. It seems wholly gratuitous to people. It's like, but they had a goal.
They had a goal. And by the way, the U.S. Embassy sent telexes back then to the State Department, if the U.S. allows the Shah to come in, we could be taken hostage here. I mean, that exists. Those telexes exist. Those communications do exist. So it's not like the U.S. Embassy in Tehran didn't know the danger of letting the Shah in.
So they called that. That was in advance.
So, but the Shah, it was return the Shah and the money that he took. That was the other thing. It's the people's money. The Shah took the people's money. So but that's a long story to get into. But what I'm saying is, they decided to punish Jimmy Carter, which we all know the history now, or those of us who are old enough, that they wouldn't even let, once the deal was actually made, the Algiers Accord to release hostages, they waited until Ronald Reagan took the oath of office in January. Mm-hmm. At that moment, they released the hostages. That was a big FU to the United States president of the United States. And I think they're hoping, I think there's some elements in the regime who believe that if they can hold off through November and into December economically and manage, even with this stalemate in the Persian Gulf, that if Trump loses the midterm or they lose both houses, that he will have been punished for attacking Iran. And that will be the punishment. But
by the same token, they'll in a sense have less leverage then because he won't have an imminent election to fear the effects of high gas prices on, right?
Yes, that's true. That's absolutely true. Yeah. But the argument with Jimmy Carter, which is, again, this is where it's contradictory, is they also didn't think, they knew that Jimmy Carter was going to be a better president for them in terms of making deals or no longer being in conflict than Ronald Reagan, who had basically had this very strong, I'll attack anybody. They thought of Reagan but yet they were willing to punish Carter. So I don't think they think these things through in a way that we're talking. I think there's just this sense of, revenge right now.
Yeah. You do get a sense from listening to various sources in Iran that there are people there who are paying a lot of attention to our system and how it works. I often think that they understand us better than we understand them. But, my thinking about what they were thinking had been more like they feel that as the election approaches, Trump will ultimately have to relent. And in the hopes of freeing up traffic in the Strait of Hormuz, concede Iran's control of it, which would lead to robust traffic in the Strait of Hormuz. Yeah. And presumably the Red Sea as well.
They also know that for Trump, for the flow of oil to get back to normal will take a while. It can't be overnight. There's still, over 1,000 ships stuck in the Persian Gulf.
No, but of course, I wouldn't necessarily assume Trump is thinking that clearly. But if you're them, and you're imagining what Trump is thinking, but
I think by September, I think the Iranians, by September, we're talking a month from now, by the middle of end of September, when the UN General Assembly is in New York, if by then there isn't any movement, we're still in this sort of stalemate situation with economic pressure on Iran. If by then Trump hasn't decided that he's going to try to save the midterms by getting the flow of oil back and getting the price of oil down, price of gas down, and being able to declare some sort of victory, then it's going to be too late.
Well, that's the challenge, is he wants to be able to declare some kind of victory, and that's just not that easy to do. And even the remotely plausible way that he could at most hope to do it. I just don't know. I just think he's a super simple-minded guy, and that's why.
It sounds that way because it's very, I don't even know who, again, as I said, I don't know who's advising him, because it would be, even on a domestic political side, how easy would it have been for him, even at the time of the MOU, to just say, we won. We bombed their nuclear facilities. They don't have the ability to extract that uranium without us knowing it. We will then bomb them again if they do. We've destroyed their Air Force. He keeps saying it anyway. Destroyed the Air Force, destroyed their Navy, killed their top leadership. We won. And then just leave.
And he had endured the political pain of getting the MOU done. He had had his few days of, you sold us out. Okay, fine. Things were calming down. And then he fucked it up. It's just unbelievable.
But it's also similar, almost it bears some similarity to his deal with Saudi Arabia on the nuclear issue. Makes a deal, they're going to enrich uranium on Saudi soil. Somebody points out to him, oh, no, you can't do that. And then he says, no, they're not going to. Yeah.
I mean, well, he says, asterisk, as long as you sign on to the Abraham Accords, even as the West Bank is being ethnically cleansed and people are being killed in Gaza, not going to happen, right?
Right.
And
yeah.
So
he blows that up on the basis of whatever people told him afterwards. I honestly don't think he ever read them MOU. Or I don't honestly don't
think. I'm willing to believe that he had no idea.
And if you look at the video of when Rubio is handing him the paper in Versailles, of all places, to sign, Rubio's face looks like he's just about to like start crying. Mm. I mean, it was clearly something that, you know, Vance had sort of put together in some ways, and Rubio did not. But he's standing there, he hands him the paper, and Trump doesn't read it, doesn't look at it, just does his big signature.
Well, that's why I think probably whoever convinced him to start this Omani corridor thing probably said to him, they are violating the MOU. And he believed him because he didn't know what the understanding had been. And the language is vague, even if it's pretty clear.
It's still not 100%. You know, it's not airtight. Yeah. I agree. But it also could have been somebody telling him, hey, listen, you signed this, but we could still do this. Someone like Hegseth, we can still escort ships out the other way and screw the Iranians.
Yeah.
That's also a possibility.
There's a loophole in the MOU. Yeah. Yeah,
we could do this and get away with it.
So as of now, what do you put much stock in these recent U.S. claims that there's this covert operation that's actually helping significant quantities of oil get through on the Omani side?
I don't think it's significant. I think there are some. Yes, there is some. There's no question. There are some ships. Tanker trackers have seen, but it's not 10, 15 million barrels a day. It's closer to 5 million. And by the way, a couple of those ships have been attacked. Iran has attacked them.
Well, very recently, they actually killed somebody on a
Dubai ship. Yeah. And there's also what we referred to earlier when we talked about, did the Emirates give money to Iran in exchange for something? There is also this, whether it's a rumor or it's been going around, certainly inside Iran, that Iran had agreed with the Emirates that it would do ship-to-ship transfers with their ADNOC, the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, so that they could get some Iranian oil out through the Abu Dhabi channel as well. So there's all these different ideas that are going around.
Yeah.
These are all conspiracy theories on some level, but usually with conspiracy theories, there's some element of truth to them.
Now, what do you make of the current status of the, you know, the Houthi-Saudi Arabia fight? Because, you know, I'm kind of surprised that oil futures aren't higher than they are when you take into account the fact that not only is Hormuz still at least somewhat bottled up, but, you know, in the Red Sea, you know, the fighting between Saudi and the Houthis has had an impact on traffic. I don't know what the current impact is over the last few days, but what is the state of play there and the prospects for resolution? I mean, to some extent, I guess the Houthi-Saudi conflict has turned into a conflict in Yemen where the Houthis are fighting the Saudi proxies. And so there's a lot of that going on. But I gather, in addition, there's still some constriction of tanker traffic in the Red Sea?
Mostly Saudi traffic, yes.
Okay, so they're letting non-Saudi traffic through.
I think they're not applying. Well, two things are important about the Houthis. One is, you know, Iran, it's always, you know, the media and the government, the people always talk about the Houthis being a proxy of Iran. Of all the groups that are allied to Iran, they're the least proxy-ish, if you will, in that they don't take orders from Iran. They are allied to Iran. Iran has given them missiles, has given them money, has given them the ability to build their own missile. They build their own missiles now in Yemen. But they don't take orders in the way that Hezbollah would sort of have to, and some of the Iraqi militias would. Hamas also was not a proxy in the way that Hezbollah and the Iraqi militias, Shia militias, are. Hamas and Iran were on different sides in the Syrian civil war, on opposite sides. Mm-hmm. But the Houthis, I don't think Iran wants to activate that channel, although now with this new economic pressure, that may be a channel that they do try to activate with the Houthis. Say, look, guys, just block everything. You know, just don't, you know, it's not just the Saudis anymore. There should be no oil going through the Red Sea, through the Bab. But I don't think they've wanted to, you know, this thing about escalation is, I mean, Iran is they're not, going back to whether we use the word lashing out or not, Iran is pretty rational in how they take these steps. And with the Houthis, whether they'll be able to activate them to, you know, close it off completely to all traffic, the Red Sea. I don't know if the Houthis will go along with that, but they might. They might. And I think that Iran isn't going to play that card until it has to. The only card that they've played when they had to was Hormuz, the Strait of Hormuz. Once they had to play it, they played it. But they hadn't played it even after the June attack when they were attacked, you know, bombed their nuclear site. They could have easily activated it then. But they were still thinking that they were going to negotiate.
So if what the Houthi is doing in the Red Sea does not come in response to strong Iranian encouragement, that suggests that the Saudis, is that a dog?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Coco, stop it.
Very responsive dog. That was good.
Sorry.
You sure it's a real dog that responded that well? To, I mean, is that an AI dog?
No, it's a real dog. I don't know. She's upset that I'm talking to you, but. Anyway.
Oh, well, understandably.
You
what kind of dog is that? I want to see the dog. Show us the dog.
Coco, come here.
Show us the dog.
Coco, come here right now.
Because that sounds like a smallish dog. And look, I love small dogs.
Get up.
I'm just wondering how much I should fear it.
Get up, Coco.
Coco. Let me see. Oh, that's a dogish face. That is a classic dog. What kind of dog is that?
It's a Vizsla, Hungarian pointer.
Whoa. Pretty doggy looking. I like that dog.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Coco, now you've had enough. Sorry about that.
No, that was the highlight of the podcast.
To talk about the Houthis, sorry.
It sounds like the Saudis really did miscalculate when they attacked the airport in Yemen.
Yes.
Because Iran had violated some Saudi rule about planes going between Iran and Yemen or something. Yeah. It just seems like a dumb time to start a war.
Yeah, it was a dumb time to say. I mean, but the Saudis often get themselves into these situations and find it difficult to get out of them. I mean, the initial war with Yemen, they couldn't, even with U.S. intelligence, U.S. arms, U.S. airplanes, with U.S. refueling, everything, they still couldn't defeat this band of basically a militia in Yemen across the border. Yeah. It just goes to show you, I think, and it goes to also this war, U.S. war on and Israeli war on Iran, that you can't defeat an enemy that doesn't want to be defeated at the end of the day.
Yeah. MBS is just not a font of wisdom. And age doesn't seem to be doing the job. I don't know, man.
No, he's
made some bad calls. So before we go into overtime, what do you make of the Saudi-Pakistani-Turkey alliance, which is basically just the addition of Turkey onto an arrangement between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, right?
I think it's for show. I doubt very much that Turkey, a NATO country, is going to come to the aid or consider an attack on Saudi Arabia to be an attack on Turkey. And the same with Pakistan. But I think it's largely for show. Not that it's completely irrelevant, but I think that in response to what's been going on with the U.S. in the Persian Gulf, I think this is like one way of these countries that are not in the Abraham Accords saying, not only are we not going to be in the Abraham Accords, and not only but we're also not really going to rely 100% on U.S. security in the region. And with Turkey, that adds an element of, you know, it brings in NATO basically into this alliance with Saudi Arabia. And well, we know how Turkey feels about Netanyahu and the Israeli government, but
that's, I mean, one thing you hear is that, you know, different members of this alliance want security against different countries from it to the extent they get any. And one thing Turkey's worried about is Israel. It still blows my mind that Israel might be thinking about actually starting a war with Turkey, but people say it's not impossible.
I don't think anything's out of the question. I mean, the important thing I think with the Saudi-Pakistani-Turkey alliance is that Pakistan's a nuclear power.
Right. They all bring something to the table. Yeah.
That brings something to the table. I mean, it brought something to the table for the Saudis, but now it brings something to the table for Erdogan as well.
Because
he doesn't have nukes. He won't be allowed to have nukes as long as he's in NATO, unless he just decides to leave NATO, which I don't think he wants to. Having a partner that does have nukes is an interesting thing.
You know, Turkey did have nukes, but
yes,
John Kennedy, in order to solve the Cuban Missile Crisis, secretly agreed with Russia
to give
that NATO would withdraw its nuclear missiles from Turkey, and then that was the end of it.
Yep.
So in overtime, as I said, you got to know former Iranian President Ahmadinejad a little by serving as his translator on his visits to the U.S. The reports have come out that he was cultivated as a Mossad asset and that maybe we had him in mind to take over the government after the regime's change that didn't work very well. As I said, I have a little anecdote to share about that. But in any event, when we go into overtime, I want to get your take on all that.
Okay.
It's kind of amazing. I mean, when I first heard that Ahmadinejad was the guy they had in mind, I mean, you, like me, old enough to remember the history, it's kind of nothing short of hilarious because he was the officially designated Iranian demon. He was the epitome of the Iranian threat. He said things that others hadn't said, and we'll get into all that. But anyway, to get access over time, you just need to be a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter. Doesn't cost much. Then you get access to all the overtimes and all the podcasts and other benefits. And hope you will follow us into overtime. Link is in the show notes if you want to become a Non-Zero member. In any event, thanks to everybody who's followed us this far. Now we're going into overtime.